The religious landscape's a really fascinating study. I'm not talking about trees and bushes and flowers with landscape. I'm talking about the religious landscape describes who's out there and what their religious beliefs and practices are, how they've bunched up in groups. And you might not get a good overall sense of this just naturally without studying it, of course, because you know your family, your local area well, but of course, the United States, and I'm speaking in terms of the United States, it's a big country, and so it takes a little research. And Pew Research, I think, comes up with very solid studies of what the religious landscape of the United States looks like. Good investigation. Who's out there? Who are the Christians, and what kind of churches are they in? Well, when you look at this, you say that the United States is roughly 25% evangelical Protestant. Now, stop there, and let's define this important term, evangelical. There are lots of, you hear that term in the news and in social media. What is an evangelical? There are lots of definitions. The only one that interests me or fascinates me is the one that's the religious definition of who is an evangelical. It's generally the Christian who talks about a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, that you enter into. You must experience salvation, come to him, and give yourself to him. These are also Christians that play close to the scriptures. They believe that there's something wrong with the human race. It needs to be saved, and a person needs to come and give their life to Christ. That's the language of evangelical Protestantism. And we, here at London Christian Fellowship, fall in a little category called Anabaptists. We would be thrown into the pile of evangelical Protestants, but it isn't a perfect fit. So that's 25% of the population. Then you have the so-called mainline Protestants. These would be the big old rich churches, downtown and big stone buildings. And they used to dominate the landscape of the United States, but that began to change in pretty much the mid-20th century, 1950s, 1960s. And it was one of the great shifts in the religious picture of the United States was the decline of mainline Protestantism. They're down to about 15% of the population at this point. It was a big change when that happened. About 20% of the United States is Roman Catholic. About 23% of the United States is unaffiliated, not religious. Roughly, though, 7 out of 10 persons in the United States would identify with the Christian faith in some way. But I say in some way with a lot of, I don't know, strange fonts and quotation marks and things like that. Not in a way that would necessarily please a pastor at London Christian Fellowship, but some identification with Christian faith. And you probably heard about the rising number of nuns. That's not N-U-N-S, Catholic sisters, that's N-O-N-E-S, none of the aboves that are there. And that's a growing group. And this is what Pew has to say about them. Religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, a shorthand we use to refer to people who self-identify as atheists or agnostics, as well as those who say their religion is nothing in particular. They now make up roughly 23% of the U.S. adult population. This is a stark increase from 2007, the last time a similar Pew Research study was conducted, when 16% of Americans were nuns. During this same time period, Christians fell from 78 to 71%. That would be, said, one of those who identify in some way with Christian faith. Well, that's an interesting picture of the landscape, the religious landscape out there, and perhaps it's a strange place to start a sermon on baptism, but that's where we're going with this. When you look at the religious landscape and you look at the groups that are in that, we said that about 25% of our country is evangelical Protestant. And I said that a group like LCF, we would be considered the Anabaptist Mennonite world in there. We fit in there, but you have to do a lot of pounding to get this square peg in the round hole. It's there, but it needs to be hammered a little bit in order to make us fit. Who are these evangelical Protestants? Well, if you take the 10 largest Protestant denominations, you will see that 4 out of 10 of those denominations are called Baptist, some way or another. Baptist is in their name. The Southern Baptist group, if you know that, by far they're the largest Protestant denomination represented. There are some 16 million of them. That's huge, because the next biggest Protestant group would be the Methodists, and they aren't even half that size. So when you look at the evangelical Protestant world, you see that there are a lot of Baptists out there. Now, it's said, just to put some perspective in here, another source, that if the independent, non-affiliated kind of, you know, the Lamb's Fellowship that meets at the bowling alley kind of churches, you know, that aren't connected to any denominational structure, if you put all of those guys together, they would actually be about the third largest group after the Southern Baptists, after the Methodists, if you added all those people together. But they don't all have the same, I mean, it's hard to find on what grounds other than the fact that they're not affiliated with anybody, you'd glue them all together in a category like that. If you look at those top 10 denominations again, Baptists of some stripes dominate the landscape. But if you take that 10 again and look at six of those groups in the top 10, they would practice baptism in a way that would be acceptable to the Baptist groups. Do you follow that? They don't call themselves Baptists, but the baptism they practice would be acceptable to Baptists. And that is, they don't baptize infants. They insist on baptism of older persons based on a conscious confession of faith, of Christian faith. So, for instance, if you were to jump from among these denominations, you were to move to a different town and jump from one to the other, you might have to change some things you do or some things you believe, if you can. But one thing that probably won't be required of you is that you would be rebaptized or would need to be baptized with that group. Okay, that's interesting when we're talking about baptism. At LCF, we call ourselves Anabaptist. And, of course, the explanation that always has to go out to the first timer who's never heard that term is this is Anabaptist, not Anti-Baptist. It is a word that roughly means rebaptizer. And it turns out we actually started this stuff in Western church history. The Anabaptists, and then we'd have to go back about 500 years to do this, did not consider their baptism as infants in the Roman Catholic Church to be valid. So they had themselves rebaptized, and they got the name Anabaptist. And they were the forerunner of all the modern Baptist groups that are out there in this regard. And all of them recognize that, of course, that this is kind of where this ball begins to roll. Now, it turns out this was not easy to do 500 years ago. The church was dominated by the Roman Catholic world in the West and also by the beginnings of the Protestant church, and they did not like this Baptist attitude at all. And so the Anabaptists suffered badly for it. Way back in 1529, the Edict of Speyer was passed, and this is what I'll tell you about it. The first imperial law was passed against the Anabaptists, threatening death to anyone who did not recognize infant baptism. I'll read you an excerpt from it. Each and every rebaptizer or rebaptized person, man or woman of an accountable age, shall be brought from natural life to death with fire, sword, or the like, according to the circumstances of the person without previous inquisition of spiritual judges. That's such a polite way to talk about the fact that they're going to kill you. You will be brought from natural life to death, and this will be done by fire, sword, or the like. I can only imagine what the like might have involved there. Continuing, against the preachers and leaders of the sect, as well as those who persisted in the same or fell back into it, no mercy shall be exercised, but the threatened penalty shall be ruthlessly performed. Rob and I are in trouble. Those who confess their error, recant, and beg for mercy may be pardoned. Whoever does not have his children baptized shall be considered an Anabaptist. No pardoned person shall be permitted to emigrate so that the authorities can see to it that he does not backslide. No prince shall receive the subjects of another who have escaped. This mandate shall be in all points most strictly performed by all in order to perform the duties and the oaths to the emperor and the empire and to avoid the serious displeasure and punishment of the emperor. Just a note, you know, back in those days when you had an emperor, avoiding his displeasure was a good idea. So this is going out in the Holy Roman Empire. It was called. It dominated all of Central Europe. But the situation wouldn't have been much different in what becomes Italy or what becomes France or England. Those would be a little bit outside the territory we're talking about here. But the same things and same types of laws are passed. And as it turns out then, because of this belief, you might say in baptism, thousands would die. About 500 years ago. Some estimate this number, although records are hard to add up and keep, 4,000 martyrs on this issue of baptism. That was the marker. That said, you were one of these horrid Anabaptists. Other Baptist movements, of course, were also persecuted in other lands, but it's a history, and this church movement, it's a history that is born in persecution and in martyrdom. And it's the most sordid kind. It's Christians killing Christians. It's terrible. It's such an indictment of us all. Baptism seems like such a little idea when you think about it. Such a little thing to die for, right? It's just a ritual. It's just water, isn't it? Maybe it's just theology. Maybe you could be a little bit more flexible on this. Maybe it's a minor thing. What was wrong with those people 500 years ago? Well, that's still a good question. What was wrong with those people? But maybe we elaborate here. To most Christians, it isn't just water. In the case of the Roman Catholic Church, for example, it's a sacrament. The act itself, the water itself, are the means to salvation. You aren't saved unless you are baptized. And this happens to you when you're an infant, whether you're aware of it. Well, obviously you wouldn't be aware of it. You were, at that point, when the priest takes hold of you as an infant, you are exorcised. The Holy Spirit the devil is driven out of you. And the Holy Spirit is imparted through the act of the water of baptism. We're not speaking figuratively here. These things actually work in and of themselves. They have that power. The Holy Spirit was placed in you. Well, of course, we don't believe that here. The Baptist groups don't believe that generally. We don't have a sacramental understanding of baptism. But we have a belief that still, it's a very, very important marker. That it's first and foremost a statement, a declaration of faith and intention. And this step then would obviously have to be taken or made by a person who is competent to make it, not by an infant. Candidates for baptism are saying for themselves, I've turned, and I'm still turning to Christ. They're not saying they are perfect, but that they are now in motion and going in a different direction. And they're declaring intentionally that something has happened internally to them. They've been touched somehow by God, and they believe in Him. Not a feeling exactly, is it? Those of us who experience the presence of God probably say it's hard to describe because it's not exactly a feeling. It's an awareness of His presence in our lives that seems to go beyond both thought and feeling. Christians are typically baptized in Baptist groups at the beginning of their Christian life, not midpoint or at the end. So they're just starting out. And it can go without saying then that people and candidates for baptism generally are working with knowledge that hasn't settled down quite yet. It's new, and it's probably basic, and of course it will grow. But they're declaring they're going in that direction. They're declaring something else too. They're identifying with God's people then through the act of baptism. The baptized are becoming one of us, joining us, so to speak. There's no convincing picture of a biblical picture of a person who gets baptized then as a free agent and goes out on their own. I'm afraid if you're baptized, you become one of us. You become a Christian, and you become one with all Christians. If you have yourself baptized, it is done by the church and in front of the church as a testimony. Otherwise, I suppose you could just, you know, sort of light some candles in the bathroom and jump in the shower after a prayer and come out. I mean, it would be a fine personal ritual, but it would not join you to anything, would it? Except, you know, the hygienic or something. It just wouldn't get you there. Baptism is a declaration, and the act itself pictures certain things, doesn't it? For instance, if you are immersed in baptism, it pictures you rising from the grave into a new life. If you have water poured over you, it signifies the pouring out of the Holy Spirit on us. Do you know our denomination here makes no critical distinction between those two modes of baptism? You could be baptized either way. Now, our Southern Baptist friends don't like that at all, I've found out. But actually, the pouring of water, symbolizing the pouring out of God's grace and Holy Spirit, was much more common in our denomination until very recently in its history. But either way is fine with us. It's the reality that matters. Baptism is a declaration. And by being a ceremony of the church, it then has to be an informed statement about what a person is doing. And this informed part is very vital because it protects people. It protects people from engaging in a mindless ritual here. Because you know there are lots of degraded good intentions and warm religious feelings in the world. Folk religion is full of sentiments that don't find any kind of place in the Bible. But by the church, in a sense, being responsible, the custodian, administering this rite, it brings clarity to a person. So ask that person, are you authentically experiencing God and putting yourself on this track? Or is some other kind of, I don't know, pseudo-Christian feeling or thought just seized hold of you for the moment and popped into your head? See, we say, well, baptism, if God is not in it, if it isn't a declaration of what God has done in your life, then it's just playing with water. It's of no value to us as a church. So baptism might seem like a small thing to you in a way, but it stands at the very heart of authentic faith. Now, I have some other points I want to make about baptism, but let's go into a scriptural passage here. And I'm going to look at Acts chapter 10. Acts 10, I'm sure you're familiar with the story if you're around studies at all. Acts chapter 10 is the story of Peter and Cornelius. Cornelius, the centurion, right? The head of the Italian cohort. And how he meets Peter. Now, it's a long chapter, and I can't read the whole thing to you, so I'm going to summarize. I'll read several verses and kind of track the story until we get down to verses 44 through 48, and those are the ones I want to concentrate on because they come back to this theme of baptism for us. So if you want to follow along, it's fine. If you just want to kind of track the story with me, that might even be better because you won't get confused as I skip a few verses here. There was a certain man in Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian regiment, a devout man, one who feared God with all his household and gave alms generously to the people and prayed to God always. About the ninth hour of the day, he saw clearly in a vision an angel of God coming in and saying to him, Cornelius! And when he observed him, he was afraid and said, What is it, Lord? So he said to him, Your prayers and your alms have come up for a memorial before God. Now send men to Joppa and send for Simon. He will tell you what you must do. Okay, so we're in Caesarea. It's up off the coast, you know, about, you know, what, 65, 70 miles from Jerusalem, up on the coast of the Mediterranean there. And we've got an Italian soldier, a commander there, and he's been a great, great follower of God in the Jewish sense of this, even though that's not his background. He's given lots of alms. He has a vision of an angel and says, send and get Simon. Now, Simon, of course, is Peter from the Gospels, the one you know. He's in Joppa, oddly enough, which is about 40 miles away to the south at this point. And at this point, or somewhere, the chronology isn't perfect, but Peter's up on the roof, meditating and praying, waiting for his lunch to be prepared, as I understand it. And he falls into a trance and has a vision in this trance. And so I'm about verse 11 here. And in this vision, what does Peter see? He sees heaven opened and an object like a great sheet bound at the four corners descending to him and let down to the earth. In it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air. And a voice came to him, Rise, Peter, kill and eat. But Peter said, Not so, Lord. I've never eaten anything common or unclean. And a voice spoke to him again the second time. What God has cleansed, you must not call common. This was done three times, and the object was taken up again into heaven. Now, you know how this works with the Jewish kosher laws, right? I mean, there are all kinds of things that the pious Jew of Peter's day can't eat, right? Shellfish and pork, and you can't mix dairy and meat dishes together, and you know all the various dietary laws that are laid out for the Jew. Now, isn't it interesting? Peter's hungry, and he falls into this trance, and he has this vision of animals, and he's told to kill and eat. But then God can't do that. That would be a temptation for him. But God says, what I have cleansed, you must not call common. The Old Living Translation of the Bible has one of the most unfortunate and humorous translations ever of that passage, in which God says, don't contradict God. If I say it's kosher, it's kosher. I can't figure out if that's an abomination or just plain brilliant, but it's an interesting one in any event. Well, while Peter's coming out of his trance, the messengers from up in Caesarea arrive in Joppa at the door, and Peter invites them in, and they tell him why they've been sent for him. And so we pick up the story again. On the next day, Peter went away with them, and some brethren from Joppa accompanied him. And the following day, they entered Caesarea. Take him a day. Now, Cornelius was waiting for them and called together his relatives and close friends. So we skip a little bit more, and Peter has his opening remarks to his family and friends in the house of Cornelius. You know how unlawful it is for a Jewish man to keep company with or go to one of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean. Therefore, I came without objection as soon as I was sent for. I asked then, for what reason have you sent me? Right? He still doesn't quite know the full story, or at least he wants to check it out here. And Cornelius replies, would be down in about verse 33 here, we are all present before God to hear all the things commanded to you by God. So Peter, once again, put on the spot, begins to speak. Peter opened his mouth and said, in truth, I perceive that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, whoever fears him and works righteousness is accepted by him. And he begins to tell them about Jesus. Of Jesus, him. God raised up on the third day and showed him openly, not to all the people, but to witnesses chosen before by God, even to us who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. To him all the prophets witness that through his name, whoever believes in him will receive remission of sins. That's Peter's sermon thus far. And as I said, 44 through 48 are the text I want to read connected to baptism. While Peter was still speaking these words, the Holy Spirit fell upon all those who heard the word. And those of the circumcision who believed were astonished, as many as came with Peter, because the gift of the Holy Spirit had been poured out on the Gentiles also, for they heard them speak with tongues and magnify God. Then Peter answered, can anyone forbid water that these should not be baptized who have received the Holy Spirit just as we have? And he commanded them to be baptized in the name of the Lord. Then they asked him to stay for a few days. So what does this passage tell us about baptism? Well, I think it's critical to understand it in these terms. God dispenses his Holy Spirit. What a shock this was in the context that we're in here with Peter, because we're about 4 years after the time of the resurrection of Christ at this point, roughly. Chronology in the book of Acts is hard to determine. But the gospel has kind of gone out into the Jewish world a little bit. It's now made its way into Samaria. They were real surprised when the Holy Spirit worked in Samaria the same way that he had worked in Jerusalem. And now suddenly into the Gentile world, the Holy Spirit has arrived. And yet we have we might have Pentecost and then a couple of mini Pentecosts, a Samaritan Pentecost and now a Gentile Pentecost. God dispensing his Holy Spirit. This part of it, if the church is the custodian of the rite of baptism, this part is under no one's control. It's not under church control. This is between you and God. And it's for everyone. It's full of hope. It's for all nations. Look at the national and ethnic thing that's going on here. I mean, doesn't this say to the modern world, God is not black or white or Asian. It's God's Holy Spirit is going to be poured out on all people. And then he brings up this idea of the remission of sins. Well, I think that's key to understanding it and putting a person in the disposition in which the Holy Spirit does come into their life. For many people, you know, I mean, the modern world, sin is a quaint concept. It's not really a category. It certainly wasn't for me growing up. I didn't sit around thinking about sins I was committing. It just wasn't in my vocabulary. You could do things right or wrong, but sin was some kind of a specialized spiritual term. But Christians, suddenly sin becomes an operative category. They sense that there is something between me and God. It's not right. A Christian pretty quickly learns that we Christians believe there will be a judgment and that we want to be free, not just from the rotten things we've done and the hold they have on us just personally, but from the ultimate consequences of the fact that we are sinful, that God will judge this world. The remission of sins can't be removed from the idea of baptism or the receipt of the Holy Spirit. Baptism, though, as you notice in this passage, follows God's work in a life. It doesn't begin it, it follows it. Something has already happened. And it's a promise, a hope for those people who seek lost or broken people that the church holds out baptism. But it's not saying baptism does it. It says that the invitation comes from God itself. And it goes to all people, regardless of their race, their ethnicity, what happened in Cornelius' house, what had happened earlier to Samaritans, and what had happened in Jerusalem itself, would finally be available to all people. Here at Cornelius' house, it's just an amazing thing, because this is when the ship actually leaves the dock and sails into the world where it eventually gets to us. Within 15 years, you'll have the church develop at Antioch, under Paul and Barnabas's leadership that in a sense changes the entire picture of the church. But you see how long it takes it to get there. It's a good 17 years before the church moves from its Jewish root out into the Gentile world. But it all starts here with this happening with Cornelius. Baptism is a response, then, to the invitation first God makes to the world to come in and be made new, to find satisfaction, to find fulfillment, to find healing. And the fact that God delivers on that promise is then marked by baptism. Part of the essential faith of this, then, the question the church has is, the Holy Spirit has come to us. It's our faith, and come into us. He's there. There's no real Christian faith to be considered unless we're reborn through the Holy Spirit. Now, I feel we all experience this differently. You know people who describe this sometimes in terms that perhaps you relate to or perhaps you don't. You wonder, well, maybe I'm missing something. But I don't believe you are if you call upon God sincerely. I just think people experience this quite differently from one another. For some, it's quite emotional. For some, it's not. I know for some it's a tremendously happy thing. I've known those who have experienced the coming of the Holy Spirit into their life as troubling, not peaceful at all, an unsettling experience. Speaking from my own experience, it was just peaceful. It was hopeful. It was full of healing in a life that needed it. And I knew I was experiencing something that was not being generated from inside of me, but coming from outside of me. I don't know that I could say anything that would convince anybody of that, except that the experience was authenticating for me. I didn't believe it originated somewhere deep in my hypothalamus and just, you know, released endorphins into my system, but that something had come upon me that changed my world. And it was only after the fact that I would find out that, in fact, this is the Holy Spirit working in my life. I believe this can happen to anyone who calls on God in sincerity, who understands this idea of the remission of sins. When this happened for me, I did not know much, and I had much to learn, and I was certainly very far from turning in any complete or comprehensive way from my sins, but I knew the direction had changed, and I was now moving in a completely different direction. Well, I'll end my sermon fairly abruptly here. Baptism is first and foremost a message of hope. It's God's invitation to us to come into his kingdom and to mark it then through baptism. It's God's work in your life then declared openly as you come into his church. It's not a tribal or family ritual. Church tries to make it that sometimes. It's not that. It's not about you and your friends or your family. And it's certainly not something to do because others expect you to do it or because others do it around you. It isn't a talisman. You know what I mean? It's not a magic ritual that somehow makes you stay in the faith. For example, if you're young, when you get older, parents might like that idea, but it has no foundation whatsoever in the scriptures. If you can't see your way clear to it, free of those kind of pressures, I'd say wait until you make this as a personal choice. But if you've given your life to Christ, if the Holy Spirit has become real to you, and you understand that the remission of sins is part of that, if you've given your life to Christ in this way, then one way to declare that to the world and to join his people formally is to consider baptism.